This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
Discover more of our shows at soundrebel.co.uk.
Hi, welcome to the Keep Real podcast, the show that explores real stories from real people with a focus on mental health. I'm Kim, and today we have reeled in the amazing Ed Lynch, who is a doctor working on the front line during the COVID-19 epidemic and founder of Life, a health and wellbeing business. Hi, Ed. Welcome to the Keep Real podcast.
Hi.
Thank you so much for your time. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. How are
good.
You?
Lovely. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. So you've been working night shifts, haven't you?
So nights finished last week. I think largely they were okay. We had a steady input of patients. It wasn't too crazy, apart from the last night. I shouldn't have actually worked it, but one of the doctors called in because he was positive for COVID, so he called in sick.
Okay.
Right. So I had to cover that. Yeah, it was a terrible night.
Yeah.
But largely it was okay. That final night we had a couple of deaths. We had a few cardiac arrests. I mean, it's not nice, but I think one of the hardest things is patients' families, because there's with COVID, we don't really have any specific treatment for it. It's like what we call supportive care. So yeah, we can use airway adjuncts if we need to, but typically it would just be you treat them with oxygen and you make sure there's nothing else. So we also give something called acetylcysteine, which if you look at, we use that for like paracetamol overdose, but it can also be, it's a antimucolytic, so it helps clear all the crap from the lungs,
right,
essentially.
Okay, yeah.
So yeah, I think dealing with the families is really difficult because they're either for escalation to ITU or, you know, a high dependency unit, or there's a ceiling of care on them. And I think having those discussions with the family is really difficult because within the NHS, there's an expectation almost that we can get most people better because it is a fantastic healthcare system. But with COVID, because it's a new disease, we haven't found treatment options for it because it hasn't been around very long, you know? So yeah, I think managing the family's expectations and keeping them in line with, of course, we're working as hard as we can for all of the people. But yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's got to be difficult, but what was it like coming into the whole COVID-19 pandemic? How was that like hearing the news and then knowing that you'll have to work it and those expectations? What was that like in the beginning?
What was it like personally, or what was it like?
Personally, yeah.
Okay. It's not something that I've reflected on too much yet because it's been so full on. But
yeah,
I think obviously there's massive amounts of uncertainty. It's a new disease. It's not been studied in any depth of time. So with that, I mean, medicine's always trying to create order out of chaos.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was just a little bit more chaos than we were used to. And there was no...
Of course.
There was no guidelines to follow per se. And we were literally doing trials on... So we were cohorting patients into groups and offering them different treatments, ever so slightly different treatments. And if we could see that there was a cohort of individuals who were doing better than others, then obviously that would direct management moving forward. So, you know, a lot of it was like an ongoing scientific study to make sure that we were optimizing patient care as quickly as possible. So that side of things was really interesting because we learn about doing experiments and setting up medical clinical trials in med school, but then to literally watch one happening, it was really interesting.
It's so interesting, but it's also one of those things that it's those experiences that you slightly prepared for but not fully mentally prepared for. So seeing those cases, do you remember your first case that you came across that was COVID-19 positive?
Yeah, I think at that point, so the test that we use, there's loads of different ways to stratify a swab. So when you swab the patients, that particular test will have a lot of statistics around how effective it is. And there's multiple different ways to assess the efficacy of that test. So at the start, because the test that we had wasn't really the negative, so it was called a false negatives, was about 20 to 25%. So if we swabbed a patient and it came back negative, there was a 20 to 25% chance that they could be positive. So if you look at statistical analyses, we would swab, and if it came back negative, we would swab again if they were still symptomatic, just to make sure. Because if you do 20% and 20%, the likelihood is reduced that over two swabs, we can make sure that that's a more correct result. It reduces the statistical anomalies, if that makes sense. At the start, my first positive COVID, I wasn't sure if it was definitely COVID, but it was just like...
Yeah. Well, there's many different symptoms that are underlying as well. And so what was that? What was the first patient like?
It was an older gentleman. I mean, he was very unwell. He was struggling for breath. And at that point, we were trying to prone the patients, like lining them on the front. Because if they lie on the front with the oxygen on, theoretically, it would open up the lung spaces at the back. But when he's of course, in isolation, he's in one of the isolation rooms. But we didn't have any proper PPE at this point. We had an apron, gloves, and a surgical mask. And the guidelines have changed pretty much daily for the past 4 weeks. So I can't remember exactly at which point we were saying what, but there was quite a lot of issues around PPE and making sure that the healthcare workers were safe, you know. It was scary when you're going into that room, and because you've got your mask on, it's actually quite hard to... We lip read quite a lot. Like when you speak to somebody, you read what the lips are doing. And I think that physical barrier that you had between you and the patient, it did create a kind of emotional barrier as well. Like having that physical barrier there made it more difficult to have like a close rapport with them. And you know, if you're breaking bad news, say, one of the things that we get taught is to use gentle contact if it's appropriate, you know, to try and support them. And obviously we can't use techniques like that to support, and it's difficult.
And that's what you want at that time as well. It's like that empathic communication. And if you've got that barrier, like how do you tell someone the news? How do you tell bad news or good news without the mask on as well? So that must be really difficult.
Yeah, and even things like lowering your voice, it's called mirroring. So if you can see that the patient's upset or depressed, or you know, you try and match the patient's energy, let's say, but you can't really soften your voice in a mask. And I think these little nuances do make a difference to patient care, so that's been difficult to manage.
Of course it is. I think as well, when so I did my degree in counseling, and it's all about, as you say, mirroring, like lowering your voice, mirroring body language as well. And obviously that must be hard. What is it like for you and your colleagues?
Well, I don't know whether you saw in the news, one of our orthopaedic surgeons, he unfortunately died, and one of his sons is training to be a medical student. I think that was very, that hit home for a lot of staff, because, you know, 1 week he's on the ward, he's treating people.
And the next.
The hearse was driving him round the hospital car park to a round of applause. So it was nice, the fact that so many people applauded him. But
it's still like a really strange form of grief that we have to go through, because it's slightly veiled. It's not the send-off that you want to give the people either. And you can't process it properly.
Yeah. So I think for nurses who... So I work on urology normally, but we were opening up extra wards and prepping those wards to become COVID wards, so it was all completely sealed off, and they were called cohort wards. So my ward became the next cohort ward, and seeing the dynamic change in the staff was it was interesting to see, because quite a few of our patients were actually nurses working within the hospital. And one of the nurses was really quite unwell. You know, he was prone. He was on the top level of oxygen that he could be on before getting tubed.
Right.
But fortunately, he's back working now. So
there are some good good sides to it, where you see people overcome and battle this strange, weird thing that we're trying to manage in all the best ways that we can. But at the end of the day, it's a new disease. We don't have all the answers just yet.
Yeah, that's it. So, yeah, I think the teams have done really well. So our ward's back now to being a normal surgery urology ward. And I think within our trust, we've got less than 100 COVID patients now, which is really good.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, so we are seeing... We're definitely past the peak here anyway. We're getting much less admissions. But what we are seeing now is that because people have been at home and they've been scared to come into hospital, say if they've got chest pain, because they've been scared to come in because of COVID, they're really unwell. Like these people have been sat at home, unwell, not coming to hospital when they should have been. And yeah, that's not good. We had a guy who... you get something called hydronephrosis in the kidneys. Basically, where your kidneys sit, you've got tubes that go down to the bladder. They're called your ureters. So he had stones in both his ureters. So
ooh,
so the water was backlogging into the kidney. So you have to basically drill into the sides of the kidneys and put tubes in to decompress it. And that's called a nephrostomy. So that nephrostomy would stay in, those tubes would stay in, but we have to flush them to keep them patent. And he missed his appointment to get them flushed because he didn't want to come in due to COVID. And now, because he missed that appointment, his kidneys have taken a massive hit. And we're not sure if he's going to have to get them removed and then be on lifetime of dialysis. And it impacts people's lives massively. And it's so much more than just COVID. It's
everything else that people rely on, or like people with chronic illness or have broken their leg or something like that that you'd go to hospital for. People are now taking a step back and thinking, oh well, I don't want to go to hospital, I don't want to maybe cause a fuss when other people are obviously dying. So it's a hard one to manage.
Absolutely. And I think it's good that the government have now come out and said that if you are unwell, go to hospital.
Yeah, they have, yeah.
People listen to the government and they're the ones that are setting the rules, basically. I'm not sure I've agreed with all of them, but I'm glad they've come out and said that because it couldn't have continued. Well, hopefully it doesn't continue how it is.
Yeah. So what do you think will happen now around the COVID-19 thing? You know, what they're talking about, well, they're talking about relaxing the rules a little bit. There was talk about, for example, you could go in your car to a walk or a hike or whatever now instead of just staying at home. What do you think about relaxing the rules at the moment?
It's really hard to say because depending which country you look at, we're further behind than other countries, and depending who we look at and the rules that they've implemented, we're seeing different rates of new cases depending on what they're doing. But then we don't know if they're adhering to social distancing. It's such a complex issue. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for me, I would, social distancing is probably going to be in place for the next 12 months ish, if realistically and rightly. We don't know how infectious COVID-19 is if you've had it once. So you can catch it again, but we don't know. There's not enough data on the study of that. We don't know if it hits you harder or, you know, we haven't walked into those territories before. So my opinion on this is irrelevant because it's just so difficult to say. I just don't know.
No one has all the answers as well. And I think we just have to literally take it day by day, moment by moment. And I think in regards to mental health, I think we'll see maybe a rise in mental health issues just as a mass human population, people with that have never experienced mental health issues may be starting to feel anxious, and that there's a form of trauma that comes with trying to get back to normality as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're already seeing it now. We're already seeing a greater presentation of mental health issues. But I have an issue with the way we approach it in the UK, to be honest, because as an ethos, we talk about mental health awareness and then we offer mental health treatments. Why aren't we helping people before it gets to the point that they need help?
Oh, I could talk about this all day. So that's why I set up Keep Real as well, because we're seeing mental health as it's either you go to the GP and they obviously see a medical side to it, antidepressants, medication, or it's a waiting list and that can take months, years, depending on what treatment. I know the NHS obviously provides CBT, but there's so many different therapies. But then what happens within that time? Like, we need to see mental health as a whole that interlinks with physical illness as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Mental health isn't, and this is another issue that I've got. We wrongly as a society, we view it as binary. We look at it, no mental health problem, mental health problem. And that's just not the way it is.
We're so complex. We're so complex as human beings.
Yeah, as in the same way that your physical health is a spectrum. You know, you sit somewhere on this distribution of being healthy. It's the same for mental health. And what I would like to see happen is a greater emphasis on education for kids in schools, just giving them really, because it's not difficult to rationalize thoughts. We just need to actually engage with that activity, you know. I think it's funny, I said I haven't reflected on the COVID thing, but I do my reflection diaries on a daily basis and look at what's happened over that day, because it's so beneficial. It keeps you rationalizing your thoughts appropriately.
Of course. And it's a different, like a cathartic process than just verbally talking about it. We used to do it in counseling. So for my 3 years, I had to do a reflective journal every day for 3 years, and I can't believe I did it. It was great. But at the same time, it puts it in a way that makes you reflect even better in a way, what you're actually thinking and the thoughts that you're processing every day. I think that's what we've got to focus on as well. It's like them small moments of, well, human connection, really, of all the little things that we can all get together and do.
Yeah, I literally can't believe how nice everyone's been, because I know we're at risk, and I know that it's a big pandemic and we are on the front line, but I kept saying, like, why are you saying thanks to us? But you know what, it's been amazing. I think I've had a couple of free meals off Uber Eats and Deliveroo.
Aww.
And then there's a little place just down the road from me, I'm by Sefton Park in Liverpool. So at the bottom of Penny Lane, there's a place called Spire, and that guy made me dinner, and he wouldn't let me pay for it. And I was like, listen, I'm paying for it because you're a small independent, you're not getting business yourself, so please let me pay for it. And he gave me a bottle of wine, bless him. So it's been really nice. It's been really nice.
So what's it been like in the hospitals, like making those connections as well?
Between staff members or?
Yeah.
So I think that there's a greater emphasis on teamwork. It's called an MDT, so multidisciplinary team. That's always been the case for the past maybe 10 years within the NHS. But there's now a greater emphasis on that. And it's great to see so many people chipping in. And we have to be so flexible. One day we might be on one ward, but then they say, right, you need to go cover this ward because we don't have the staff. And then with that, you're obviously in an unfamiliar, all of the wards are laid out slightly differently because of each, not every ward's set up for respiratory diseases, let's say. So on our ward, which was surgery, we don't have access to all of the respiratory things that we would need. And equally, when you go to, say, if you go to a gastro ward, you know, that's set up for sorting out people's stomachs and intestines and stuff. So it's hard to change the environments, and it's hard working with people that you don't know. You don't know the names. So you're like, nurse, nurse. And then everyone's like, which one? And then, so it's really, really difficult when you're in unfamiliar environments. But
I've heard that they've started writing the names like on the PPE stuff. Is that right?
Yeah. Which is really handy. But yeah, I mean, I love working with, I'm meeting new people. That's part of the job that I really enjoy. So you know, it's a pleasure working alongside these guys.
Have you had many volunteers or like extra staff being put in?
So we've had, so Liverpool Medical School, they do their final exams in fourth year. So typically, typically med school is 5 years, or you can do 6 years if you do an intercalation year.
Yeah.
But because our med school does the finals in fourth year, our fifth year medical students are fully qualified, as in like they've passed all of the exams. Okay. So the fifth year medical students have sort of like stepped up as pre-junior doctors kind of thing.
Right, okay.
So they've been taking a lot of the workload in terms of, not in terms of plans or management, but once there's a plan in place, we can say to them, look, please go and execute these jobs, which might be, say if you need to go take blood cultures or taking a set of bloods or putting the oxygen on or filling out paperwork. They've been so useful in completing that for us. So,
oh, that's lovely. So where do you think everything's going to go next? Like, what are you looking forward to now?
Yep, so our ward is back to being surgical ward, and we've got a full ward now, full set of patients, and some of them are query COVIDs, but again, they're being isolated and treated appropriately. But for me, I think we basically have three pathways that we can choose from, and they're all called MRC something, which is just, you join a college of physicians. So you can either do college of physicians, college of surgeons, or college of psychiatrists. So yeah. I'm sort of trying to work out where to go. Mm-hmm. I really, really like surgery, as in scrubbing into things and actually being very practical is a lot of fun. And it's a real privilege to be, and it's an honor to work on people in that way. It's a very surreal environment, but I love it.
So what surgeries have you done? I mean, there must be loads, but what do you do most of?
So at the moment, because I'm on urology, it's all to do with the kidneys, the renal tract, that sort of stuff. But when you're in night shifts, you won't actually lead a surgery. Of course, that'd be a consultant or a registrar. And you would, it's called scrubbing in. So you would assist them in the operation. So you're holding things for them. You're moving bowel out of the way. You're making cuts, you're suturing, that kind of thing. But when we're on nights, if there's emergencies, you just have to sort of roll with it and just get in there and see what needs doing, because you don't necessarily know what needs to be done until you're inside. So you do what's called an open laparotomy. So you go right down the middle here and just open up.
Oh, I don't know how you're not squeamish. I mean, you must. What was it like when you first started? Were you squeamish then, or have you always just been like, yep, I can definitely do that. I will hold that bowel for you.
You know, if you stand up really, really quickly.
Yeah.
And you sometimes get like the stars.
Fizzy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've had that quite a few times. And I think the first time I ever had it was when I was at med school. And you look at the cadavers and you have to do all of the anatomy training. But they have what are called prosections. They have sections of the body that they can bring out and they show you all of the anatomy to learn, like real life.
Okay.
It's all stored in this, I can't remember what the preservative is called, but it's like a bucket of this horrible smelling fluid. And it sticks in your nose for ages. And I remember there was this session and we were learning like head anatomy, and honestly it was like something off Lord of the Rings. I just could not hack it.
Slippy neck.
But how do you break yourself into that? I think they just throw you in the deep end and see how, and you do become used to it. But that, the smell that sticks in your nose, I can't have a Subway anymore, because
is that what it smells like? Subway?
Well, no, it doesn't smell like Subway, but I remember this thing, and I grabbed a BMT afterwards, and all the entire BMT just smelled to this preservative. I was like, so yeah, can't do it.
So if people are struggling right now, what would be your advice or guidance?
For mental health?
Yeah.
So yeah, we're setting up a business called Life.
I wanted to ask you about that because I read up on that. It looks amazing. Tell us more.
So essentially, it goes back years. One of my friends, he killed himself back in university, and I had a relatively tough time for about 8 months, but I've always been interested in psychiatry. I'll give you the short version because we could be talking about this for hours. But essentially, through those 8 months, I started learning about psychology and what I could do to look after my own mental health. And through that educational process, I think that I'm now much more resilient. I'm much more motivated. I can monitor my mental health much better. And it's really simple things that we can do. So it comes back to prevention to stop you having like a diagnosable condition, which would we would typically treat with antidepressants in the UK. So actually educating and putting a greater emphasis on preventative measures was really key for me to make sure that other people didn't slip off the slope, if you like. So that's why we started Life. And essentially what it is, it's a, as a brand, we want to provide as much value and resources for people to learn so that they can harbour strong mental health and physical health. So our website, I live with Toby, he's another medic. He's working on it right now. We're getting the website live, hopefully by the end of, we're aiming for tomorrow night, but it might be Monday night. But that will have tons of content on there for people to read and to learn about how to harbour strong mental health and physical health. And the difference is it's all based on medical evidence as well. So people can read it and know that it's genuine, because you read so much crap. You know, like, everyone's become an expert in things that increase your immunity. Like, eat three carrots a day. You're like, are you bevied? So, the app, what it does is it essentially incentivizes people to live a healthier lifestyle. To actually look after your mental health, you've got to look after your complete health. So the app incentivizes you to go and do that, to engage with a whole host of activities which we've backed through science that would help your mental health and your physical health. And then you get exclusive discounts to do those things through the app for the end goal of improving mental health outcomes across the UK. So, yeah, that's what it does.
Thanks so much, Ed. Honestly, it's been lovely chatting, because I think when we're looking at the news all the time, consuming lots of COVID information, it's just nice to hear it from you, and instead of the news, which feels quite sensationalised at the minute.
So. Just make sure you've got loads of Domestos in your house and UV light and you'll be fine.
Don't inject it.
What is that?
It just doesn't help anything. Like, that man is... I just don't have the right language for that man.
What is that?
Whatsoever. Yeah, inject... No.
Let's hope he doesn't get it again. Hopefully he doesn't become president again.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thanks.